Hello, I'm Father Charles Connor. Welcome to our series on the saint for the third millennium, Thérèse of Lisieux, as we consider her spiritual conquest of souls. Please stay with us.
Welcome to Saint for the Third Millennium, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. In this series, Father Charles Connor presents the life, spiritual direction, and relevance of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux for today's Catholic and for the Church in all generations. Here now is Father Charles Connor.
It would be very difficult, if not impossible, to come up with any kind of statistics on how many souls have been affected by Thérèse of Lisieux. We're titling this broadcast, Her Spiritual Conquest of Souls, because she has brought so many souls to Christ. People who had no religion, people who were lukewarm, people who were apathetic, people who were already devout but began praying to this young nun shortly after her death and became more devout, people who became holier because of answers to prayers they attributed to the intercession of the young saint of Lisieux. So it would be incalculable to try to determine how many people in the world have been influenced by this marvelous saint since her death on the 30th of September, 1897. She was buried, you know, just a few days after her death, the following Monday, in the town cemetery of Lisieux. There had been a civil ordinance passed in France not too many years before, prohibiting the erection of cemeteries on church grounds. Therefore, one had to be buried in civil ground, and Thérèse's uncle, Isidore Guérin, had purchased a plot of land in the town cemetery for the Lisieux Carmel, where all the Carmelite sisters would be buried. And Thérèse was the first one buried in the plot in the cemetery. And almost immediately following upon her death and burial, people by the dozens, and then by the scores, and then by the hundreds came to visit her gravesite in the Lisieux Cemetery. She was moved eventually from one plot to another, and then from the second plot into the chapel of the Lisieux Carmel, where one can still venerate her remains today. All over the chapel of that convent, where she spent 9 years of her life, you find small marble plaques, most of them written in French, most of them with particular surnames on them. And what are they? They are thanksgivings for prayers that have been answered through the intercession of Thérèse of Lisieux. And not only in the Carmel Chapel, but in the various entrances to the Lisieux Carmel, until there's probably little, if any, room at all now, today, for the erection of any more of these plaques of thanksgiving. People leave flowers constantly. People light vigils. It was referred to then, and it may still be referred to as a storm of glory. So she is still exercising this spiritual conquest of souls, even in our own day and in our own time, so many years after she has left this world. Well, in this particular episode, we want to pinpoint just a few of the very well-known people who have been influenced by her, whose lives have been changed by her, and not only people whose lives have been changed by her, but people who, because their lives were changed by her, went out and in their own way spread the message of Thérèse of Lisieux to any and every person who would listen. One of the most interesting case studies involved a gentleman by the name of Vernon Johnson. Vernon Johnson was born into a well-to-do English family in 1886. He was a religious man by temperament. He had studied to become a minister of the Church of England. And he became a minister of his church in 1910. His first assignment was as a parish curate in the town of Brighton. Brighton is a town along the seacoast, probably about 1 hour by train from London. And in that first parochial assignment, Vernon Johnson would remain for 3 years. And as he was pursuing his duties as a parish curate of an Anglican church, He began to yearn more and more for an intense form of spiritual life. And of course, within the Anglican Church, it is not at all uncommon to have specific religious communities. And it was the life of a religious community that seemed to appeal more and more to Vernon Johnson. It was the way in his life where he felt he could become closer to our divine Lord by leading a more monastic sort of life, a life which would give him greater opportunity for solitude and for prayer. And so after 3 years of service in the coastal town of Brighton, he left the parochial work that he had been doing as an Anglican curate, and he entered the Anglo-Catholic Society of Divine Compassion. Now at that time, this Anglo-Catholic Society of Divine Compassion wore the Franciscan habit, the brown habit with which all of us have great familiarity, the cord, the rosary, and so forth. So one would look at Vernon Johnson and think that he was a Franciscan in the Catholic tradition. Well, this life of solitude and prayer that he was so very happy to be a part of in this Society of Divine Compassion led him to think that there were other ways that he could take what he was receiving as a result of this religious community experience and give it to others. And so he and a number of like-minded men who were fellow members of this religious society decided that they would open a home in London for the care of leprosy. You would not think leprosy would be as much of a concern in those days, but it was. It was something that was still very, very much with us, and something that had to be tended to. And he opened what eventually became known as St. Giles Home. And St. Giles Home was indeed a very successful enterprise in London. From there, he went to work in London's East End with the poor. The First World War was on by now, and since there was no place to escape from air raids on the East End of London, Father Vernon and a number of his companions went from house to house, staying with any of the people whom they knew who would take him in the event of an air raid. And of course, people in London were living in continuous fear of air raids, as we know so well, at that particular period of time. Well, when the air raids had ceased over London, they returned to their own small religious community of monks, only to find that their monastery had been destroyed in an air raid. But very curiously, one thing was left. And the one thing that was left of their monastery was a rather sizable crucifix. Isn't it interesting? Everything else had been destroyed, but the crucifix had been preserved. Well, after the war, Vernon Johnson went on to serve in several Anglican houses of his order. And he was very much sought after as a popular retreat master. So he would go around to all the various Anglican churches preaching at the particular and uniquely Anglican devotions that one found in Anglican churches at that time. In 1924, Vernon went to make his annual retreat. And as is the case so often when we're making a retreat, we like to have some kind of spiritual reading to do. And so an Anglican nun gave Vernon Johnson a copy of Thérèse's Story of the Soul, the autobiography, to read when he was on retreat. And Vernon Johnson's reply to the Anglican nun was very simple and very direct. "No thanks," he said. "It's French and it's Roman Catholic." And because it was French and it was Catholic, he did not have any particular interest in it. Now, this Anglican nun must have been somewhat blunt, I suppose we can call her, because she immediately retorted to Vernon Johnson, "Oh, don't be prejudiced. Take it and read it. You'll enjoy it." So he began to read The Story of the Soul, the autobiography of Thérèse. He got through the first two chapters, and as he records his impression of the first two chapters of The Story of the Soul, he said, "The thought that kept running through my mind was, what an appalling, pious little prig." She didn't impress him at all. He thought he was right. She was French and she was Catholic, and what does she have to say to me, an educated Anglican clergyman? But for some reason or other, Vernon Johnson kept reading the autobiography. He didn't stop at chapter 2. He went on and continued reading. And as he did, the real Therese began to emerge. Her thoughts began to emerge. What she has to offer the world began to emerge. And he could not stop reading until he finished the autobiography. The story of the soul moved Vernon Johnson more than any other piece of religious literature had ever moved him in his life. He was so intrigued about it that he decided to go to France, to go to the town of Lisieux, make a pilgrimage, we can say, and visit Les Buissonnés. You often hear, for example, of people who are atheists, people who are skeptics, people who are doubters, and something has drawn them to the shrine of Our Blessed Mother in Lourdes. And from the experience of their visit to the shrine in Lourdes, they become changed people. Well, in much the same way, Vernon Johnson went to Therese's home, Les Buissonnés, in Lisieux, and Vernon was to become a changed man. He got there, and his first stop was the Martin home. He had read the autobiography by now so thoroughly and so completely that he was not a stranger to the home at all. He would walk through, and he needed no guide. One room followed another, because she describes them all so very beautifully in the story of a soul that he felt very, very much at home. He spoke with some French and Belgian priests. He met a classmate of Therese up in the town cemetery. The classmate was instrumental in introducing Vernon Johnson to Mother Agnes in the Carmel. And years later, this is what he wrote. I was conscious that my visit was being guided in a mysterious way. At first, it seemed coincidence, but as time went on, I knew it was more than mere coincidence, which led me, a stranger and all unknown, to kneel in the Carmel parlor and to receive the blessing of Mother Agnes, the saint's own sister. I must believe it was the prayers of the little saint herself. A year later, he returned to Lisieux, and this time he could no longer avoid the question, as he says himself, was the church which had produced a Saint Therese of the Child Jesus, was that the true church? He used to wake up at night, and he was actually crying to God. He records, he says, you cannot ask this of me. I cannot do it. I cannot become a Roman Catholic. I cannot desert the faith in which I was raised. And yet, 5 years after he had opened her autobiography, and 3 years after that second visit to Lisieux, Vernon Johnson was received into the Catholic Church. At the age of 43, after his reception into the Catholic Church, he traveled to the eternal city of Rome, where he became a student at the Beda. Now, the Beda is an English college in the city of Rome for belated vocations. It is very close to the great Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls. It has been in the city of Rome for centuries. 6 years later, at the age of 49, the former Anglican minister, Vernon Johnson, was ordained to the Roman Catholic priesthood. And within 2 weeks, he was back in Lisieux, offering the holy sacrifice of the Mass for the sisters in the Lisieux Carmel, who had been so very instrumental in his own vocation. He became, in later years, Monsignor Vernon Johnson, spoke about and preached about Therese for the remainder of his life. Very much instrumental also in the creation of the Sacerdotal Union of St. Therese of Lisieux, which is an organization of priests all over the world who are attracted to the spirituality of Therese, who have great personal devotion to her, who deeply appreciate the fact that even in heaven now, Therese continues in a very, very special way to pray for priests. There are so many thousands of priests around the world who belong to this Sacerdotal Union and who owe Monsignor Vernon Johnson a tremendous debt of gratitude. He was a great, great example, then, was he not, of Therese's spiritual conquest of souls. Then we also have the case of Mr. and Mrs. Alexander Grant from Scotland. Grant had been a United Free Minister of the Free Church of Scotland. He was the first clergyman of his church to come over to Rome. And he came over to Rome through his contact with St. Therese. Grant's wife had preceded him into the Catholic Church, And after they both became Catholics, in May of 1911, they sold their home in the city of Glasgow, Scotland, and they moved to the town of Alençon in France, where Thérèse had been born. Mr. and Mrs. Alexander Grant, for several decades, were the custodians of the birthplace of St. Thérèse of Lisieux on the Rue de St. Blaise in the town of Alençon. Today, you can go there, you can visit the house, you can see the machinery with which Zélie Martin engaged in her lace making. You can see some of the products of the watches that were repaired and the jewelry that was made by Louis Martin, who was a jeweler by profession. You can walk up to the second floor of the home and go into a magnificently beautiful chapel and pray. And adjacent to that chapel, on the second floor, is the room where Thérèse was born. It is also the room where Thérèse's mother died when she was a little girl of 4.5 years of age. From there, you can walk right down the street to the great church, parish church of St. Mary in the town square, and see the baptismal font where Thérèse and so many of her siblings were baptized. Well, Mr. and Mrs. Alexander Grant were the custodians of that home for many, many years. They remained there until Mr. Grant's death in 1917. Cardinal Désiré Mercier was the Archbishop of Malines in Belgium. He was a scholar, he was an intellect, a diplomat, the man responsible for the opening of the famed Institute of Philosophy at the University of Louvain in Belgium at the request of Leo XIII, who wanted a restoration of Thomistic philosophy. He was certainly the leader of the Catholic Church in Belgium for decades, and he did more to promote devotion to St. Thérèse of Lisieux among the Belgian people than any one of his time. Cardinal Mercier held honorary doctorates from universities around the world, yet he never lost his love for and his devotion to this simple young cloistered nun. And then finally, there is the case of Philadelphia's Dennis Cardinal Dougherty, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, for several decades until his death in 1951. Cardinal Dougherty was the papal legate to Lisieux, the representative of our Holy Father, in 1925 at the saint's canonization. But his devotion to Thérèse of Lisieux had become very, very powerful in his life many years earlier. And one time he was interviewed, and he told the reporter who was interviewing him the origin of his devotion to Thérèse. Cardinal Dougherty explained that for a number of years, he had been a missionary bishop in the Philippines, and he found in the Philippines that there was a great deal of proselytism going on. That is to say, various Christian denominations, strongly at variance with Catholicism, were winning adherents in large numbers, and Bishop Dougherty knew that he had to do something about it. And he thought, well, one of the ways to do something about it is I have to build an orphanage, and I have to build a hospital where we can bring these native Filipino people in to care for them, and then we can instruct them in the faith which had always been theirs, and strengthen their Catholicism. But of course, to build the orphanage, to build the hospital, naturally I have to raise money. And how am I going to raise money sufficient to build an orphanage and a hospital? Well, one of the sisters, a religious sister, who was working rather closely with the then Bishop Dougherty in the Philippines, had a natural sister who was a Carmelite in the Carmel of Philadelphia. And Bishop Dougherty of Jarrow in the Philippines promised his sister that when he got back to his native Philadelphia, he would go into the Carmel, to the Carmelite convent, and visit her sister. He was true to his promise. He went in, made the visit, and the portress who opened the door that day for Cardinal Dougherty had a, or for then Bishop Dougherty, had a copy of the story of the soul in her hands. And she said, just to make conversation, "Did you ever read this book, Your Excellency?" "No, no, I haven't, sister. You know, I've been over in the Philippines for a long time, and I'm not greatly familiar with all of the new saints who have been canonized. But I promise you I will get a copy of the story of the soul, and I will begin to read it." Which is exactly what he did. He bought the book, he read it, and he became consumed with devotion to Thérèse. He placed his begging campaign under her protection, and he was able to raise $200,000. Now, you say that's not a tremendous amount of money, $200,000, and it probably isn't by today's standards, but remember, the year was 1913 that he was doing the begging. He made a visit to the Carmel in Lisieux in 1913, and he was able to speak with Pauline, with Mother Agnes, He returned finally to the Philippines to do his building. And then, continuing to the same reporter in the same interview, the then Cardinal Doherty looked back on this particular period of his life. And this is what he said. In 1916, I was in Shanghai, in the Jesuit community there, and I spoke of the wonderful book of the saint and of my visit to Lijiu. A Chinese priest slipped quietly out of the room, and returning presently, gave me a copy of the book in Chinese. It was his own translation. A fortnight later, a similar incident happened in the Jesuit community in Tokyo, when a Japanese father stole out of the room and on his return presented me with his Japanese version of the autobiography. Later, when in Arabia, I was presented with a copy of it in Arabic. What Cardinal Doherty is attesting to in this reminiscence is the fact that The Story of a Soul, Therese's autobiography, is one of the most circulated books in all the world. One biographer ever said, you have the Bible, you have the Quran, and there might be two or three other books. But this particular writer said he would, at least in his own judgment, would list it as one of the five most circulated books in the entire world. There is hardly a known language into which Therese's Story of a Soul has not been reprinted. Cardinal Doherty knew this very well, and the truth of it is seen far more today in the 21st century than it was well over a half century ago when the Cardinal gave this reminiscence. But throughout his entire life as Archbishop of Philadelphia, Cardinal Doherty promoted devotion to the great saint of Lijiu. And he certainly is for us another wonderful example of her spiritual conquest of souls. Certainly in our own time, one of the very best examples of the conquest of souls that is given by Therese is the visit to so many parts of the world of her relics. This began in 1994 with a tour of the relics through her native France, and it has been continuing ever since. They've been to hundreds and hundreds of countries around the world. An interesting example of this is an article, or rather a headline, that appeared in the London Daily newspaper, The Independent. The headline appeared on October 19th, 1999, and the headline stated, "Saint stops traffic on Fifth Avenue." Saint stops traffic on Fifth Avenue. They were there by the thousands to see her at St. Patrick's Cathedral. Well, whether people saw her there at St. Patrick's or in the Cathedral Basilica in Philadelphia, which Cardinal Doherty had once served so well, or on the west coast of California, or in the Basilica of the National Shrine of Therese, that very beautiful basilica in San Antonio, Texas, which you can visit, or any of the other dozens of cities in the United States which she visited, or cities throughout the world which she has visited. It's never her relics that are coming. It is she that is coming. Most people go to a sacred holy place to make a pilgrimage. In the case of the relics of St. Therese of Lisieux, the pilgrimage is really brought to them in many, many ways. And it's interesting to note that over the course of at least 800 years, a Catholic theology of devotion to the relics of saints has developed. St. Thomas Aquinas probably put it most beautifully of all. He said, first of all, saints are members of Christ. Secondly, they are the children and the friends of God. And thirdly, they are our intercessors. So we want to come close to them to get close to God. How do we come close to a saint? By being blessed with his or her relics, pieces of their bone, their human body. We venerate the relic of a saint, and in that veneration we are showing our love of the saint, and ultimately we are showing our love for God, because all the saints lead us to Christ, who leads us to the Heavenly Father. That is why we venerate saints in the veneration of their relics. That is why it is such a time-honored tradition. As Father Christopher O'Donnell says, relics are one way in which God helps us in our bodily humanity to rise to spiritual realities. Through relics, we can feel close to a holy person. We have a deeper awareness of her life and mission and of her presence in the communion of saints. Religion, he writes, can never be purely intellectual. It must rather touch us at the different levels of our being. Well, she most certainly touches us in her relics. She comes to us through our prayers for her and our veneration of her relics. She comes to us through the pages of her magnificent autobiography, The Story of Her Soul. And she comes to us as we try ever so feebly to live our little way. That is her spiritual conquest of souls, and may she get the soul of every single one of us.
Join us next week at this time for Saint for the Third Millennium, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Heart of Mary. Amen.